Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we discuss the connection between your personal health and well-being and our total health environment, the health of our neighborhoods, communities, the health of our food, water, air, earth, all of the things that we need for life, the health of our society, and the global ecology of planet Earth, and how all of the interconnected systems and beings there create a world that is habitable for many living systems, and why we try to preserve that for the sake of our health and all health and life. I'm a longstanding health, food, and environmental journalist reporting in a variety of different venues, and this show is now entering its fifth year. So this week's show, we're going to be carrying forward something that kind of, during last week's program, we were talking about EMFs, and I received word of the passing of an extraordinary woman who not only was a pioneer, a great scientist, a far-sighted thinker, but she was also a mentor, a guide, an inspiration to many, many people working on behalf of health and the environment, and a role model, you know, really just a peerless light and heroine to many, in a sense, a living Rachel Carson for our time. And I'm speaking of Theo Colburn, who passed away last week, well into her 80s, and 87 years old, a full, long, well-lived visionary life. So we're here today with my guest, Sandra Steingraber, to pay tribute to Theo Colburn, to talk about the extraordinary far-sighted value thinking and breakthroughs that she brought to this area of health, environment, and science, to salute her, to learn from her, and to look at how we all continue to go forward based on her work and her inspiration. So let me introduce my wonderful guest, Sandra Steingraber, a biologist, speaker, leading advocate against fracking, and a prior guest on this program. Sandra is the author of Raising Elijah, Protecting Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. She's also the author of Living Downstream, an ecologist's personal investigation of cancer in the environment. She is known most recently and to a very wide group of people for her extraordinary leadership and advocacy to protect the waters, air, earth, and food of New York State and the Northeast region, as well as our country and the world, from contamination by fracking chemicals, as well as raising awareness about their contribution to accelerating climate change. It's a great honor to welcome Sandra back to Connect the Dots to share her reminiscences and inspiration and on Theo Colburn, as well as to see how she carries that forward in the extraordinary work that she's doing. So welcome back, Sandra, to Connect the Dots.
Thanks for having me, Allison.
So, you know, let's talk a little bit about Dr. Theo Colburn. She was an extraordinary scientist and a pioneer. And one of the things that she did, so many things, and I hope we'll be able to touch on some of them, her work with endocrine disruption, her far-sighted insight into the dangers of fracking. But most importantly, I mean, at least from my perspective, one of the things that Theo really stood for was the critical role of independent scientific thinking in our time. She was an independent scientist. Without that independence, a lot of the key research that she did would not have been done. You know, I'd love, so, you know, that's kind of my view, and we can discuss that, but I'd love to hear how you held in your thought, in your inspiration, in your heart, Theo Colburn, and the role that that she played for you, for this movement that you've spearheaded, and for so many people.
Well, you know, Theo was always first, right? She was the first to understand that chemicals could act as hormone disruptors in concert with each other in very low amounts and alter gene expression without ever needing to cause a mutation. So the old way of thinking that, you know, a chemical is not really toxic unless it breaks your genes was kind of overturned when she went to work showing that there were a vast number of chemicals that, at first, you know, that we were focused on chemicals that could mimic estrogen, and that in the early 90s, those chemicals went by the name xenoestrogens, the kind of artificial estrogenic chemicals. But then it became clear through her careful detective work that there were chemicals that could mess around with your thyroid hormone. There were chemicals that could block androgens and male hormones, and even glucocorticoids, which are involved in all kinds of different sort of regulatory mechanisms, ranging from our metabolic rate to various things that could cause cancer. And so so endocrine disruption is really a phenomenon that began with her. And because she had such a wide and deep training in so many disciplines, she was a wildlife biologist, but she was also a pharmacologist. She could really connect the dots in ways that a lot of scientists who were just drilling down into one kind of cellular mechanism couldn't see the whole big picture, but Theo always could. So she was kind of first in the 1990s to create a unified theory of endocrine disruption. That, of course, became the starting point for her book, Our Soul and Future. But then, when fracking first hit the scene, it was Theo who was right out front. I remember the very first scientific presentation I ever heard about this new form of fossil fuel extraction was Theo. It was like completely new to me. It was just not on the radar screen of any of us. And so I think her legacy was then to point out that the same chemicals that are responsible for deconstructing our climate system when they're combusted are also the starting points, these fossil fuels, the starting points for petrochemicals, many of which are endocrine disruptors. So she shined a spotlight on the whole environmental crisis, not just one part of it. And the whole environmental crisis, to my way of thinking, is a kind of like a tree with two trunks. On the one hand, there is climate chaos and global warming caused by combustion of fossil fuels. But then the other tree of crisis, of course, is the chemical adulteration of living things, including us, and all the health risks that poses from the toxic trespass into our bodies of inherently toxic chemicals, some of which have the ability to mimic or otherwise interfere with our hormonal messengers. And those are also the byproducts of the fossil fuel industry. So really our problem is fossil fuels. And if we could get ourselves off of those, we sort of free up the hostage that is both green energy and green chemistry. So it's really the Theo that kind of was out front on all those things before any of the rest of us. She was a very synthetic thinker that way.
Mm-hmm. And that's a rare thing, because one of the things that happens in science, because it's so diversified across so many different disciplines and areas, that people in this time, and for economic reasons as well, tend to be highly specialized. As you say, they drill down into a particular area. And so I think, you know, the title of my program, Connect the Dots, which has been a pervasive title, is really, you know, that many people have used, and I'm not the first certainly to use it at all. But the reason that's such a resonant phrase for our time is because we do have this highly narrow, specialized way of approaching science, and then we have broad systemic interactive concerns, and we don't know, our science hasn't really modeled how to put Humpty Dumpty back together again once we analyze the different parts. And in analyzing those parts, you know, that we have the whole process of scientific validation that we're accustomed to. But when we can't put it all back together again, then it creates a kind of gap in both our understanding of what these far-reaching effects are, as well as just in the public mind altogether, because people are looking, you know, for a very narrow kind of scientific proof, you know, that they've been shown is applicable before, but which, you know, fails to connect the dots and really give us a sense of the big picture of how all of these different things have cumulative impacts and affect us. Your thoughts on that?
I think that connect the dots is exactly what Theo did. And if you wanted to write the briefest obituary you could of Theo Kolbern, you would say, Theo Kolbern, she connected the dots. And she did that in two ways, I think, both in her own science, because her own mind was very wide-ranging, but also as a convener of scientists. So she brought many minds together around a round table, and that's how the theory of endocrine disruption really came to be. We give her credit as the kind of author of the theory, rightfully so, but it was because she realized that so many different scientists, both at the bench and also out in the field, had a piece of the puzzle, and that everybody needed to bring their jigsaw puzzle pieces together and put them on the table, and then let's assemble them and see what kind of picture we see here. And so she brought together people who studied subcellular molecular biology, who were looking at the nature of hormone receptors in subcellular machinery. She brought together field biologists and ecologists who were looking at reproductive failures among wildlife. Mm. She brought together public health folks and epidemiologists and clinical physicians who were finding, you know, falling sperm counts in men and increase in certain kinds of birth defects in baby boys, and then the pharmacologists and so on. And so she gathered them all physically, you know, in one place by having these kind of symposiums of hers. She had a kind of scientific salon that she held.
Did you go to these events? I mean, did you go to any of them? Did you attend?
Some of them I did, and it was very heady experience to be invited to something that Theo was convening. But there's something else too that set Theo apart from almost any living scientist I know. And that was this willingness to take science and into the public arena. And she felt very strongly, and I kind of quote her on this all the time, or at least invoke her, right? So it's just in, you know, we won this major victory in New York State when our governor declared a ban on fracking, an abiding ban on fracking in New York, and thus New York has just become, as of December 17th, the first state in the union with sizable shale gas to make a decision to leave that shale gas in the ground, that our economic well-being and our public health is better served if we don't extract that. And so at the kind of press conference that I participated in the aftermath of that announcement, you know, I heard myself kind of invoke Theo's idea that science was not like a monk that was sequestered away in the ivory tower of academia, but rather, you know, once the data analysis was done and there were signs of harm, you can be very objective, and one needs to be very objective in doing the data analysis, but once the data are in and you see that people are being harmed without their consent, then we all as scientists have a moral obligation to take that science into the public arena and insist that regulatory changes are made in response to that. And so science is, in her view, was kind of like a gladiator in the public arena rather than something sequestered away. Whereas so many other scientists, even those who do eloquent work that's really useful, feel like their day is done and their work is over as soon as the paper is published. And Theo was the most unlikely gladiator, right? Because she's this tiny woman who was always a little bit older than the rest of us. She didn't finish her PhD project until her 50s somewhere. And so all of her contributions were made in the, you know, in her 60s, 70s, and 80s. And she always struggled with health problems, including some really serious, and she always had to travel with her own food. because of all kinds of food allergies and incompatibilities. She had terrible respiratory issues. Just she was always kind of fragile and bird-like, and yet she was the most powerful warrior of them all. So many things that she fought so hard for failed. You know, the attempt, for example, to get a rational endocrine-disrupting screening tool that would be, we would have, you know, a law that required all chemicals to be screened for their ability to mess around with our endocrine system. We could do that, but the so-called EDSTAC committee in the EPA was just, it became a joke. It became, you know, every time they got close to agreeing on something, then the committee would be disbanded and people would, out of outrage, kind of resign, and it was just a really, really huge mess. But nevertheless, you know, it was a goal worth fighting for. And so, so Theo was willing to go after, to engage in battles that it was really hard, where it was really hard, and it wasn't a guarantee of a winnable victory. And that set her apart from, I would say, every scientist I know who works for a mainstream environmental organization. And there are many good scientists who do that, but they work for organizations who will only engage in winnable victories, and because they don't want to upset the regulatory agencies that they have close and ongoing relationships with, and they want to be able to go back to their funders and say, look what we did, we won. And even if winning means something like getting better regulations for fracking that actually don't help at all in the long run. It's like putting filters on cigarettes. You know, we lulled everyone into thinking that filtered cigarettes were somehow safer than unfiltered when they weren't at all, rather than simply abolishing smoking. You know, years and years were lost. And Theo ultimately was an abolitionist when it came to inherently toxic chemicals. She wasn't interested in playing around. So she was willing to stand on the science and call for what was rational and right, even when it wasn't clear that she could win. And a lot of times she didn't win. She was willing to fight the big fight. I admire that. And now we just won really big in New York, partly and no small part because of her research, but also because of her insistence that that's where science belonged. You know, if there was no, if the emperor had no clothes, if there are no signs of evidence to show that fracking could be done safely in any regulatory framework, and that is indeed our situation, then we had to say so as scientists. We couldn't participate in feeding everyone what Rachel Carson herself said were tranquilizing pills of half-truth by claiming that, oh, well, we'll just, you know, demand that we'll have one more well casing, or we'll have, you know, we'll require divulgence of certain chemicals. And that was just not enough for Theo. And so she, you know, her whole idea was to go big. And I've taken that very seriously.
How did she, you yourself are a scientist, and I'm sure you didn't necessarily set out to be a public warrior that you've become, because they're almost, you know, it's a very unique combination of skills and temperaments, you know, as well as social structures that kind of mitigate against, traditionally people carrying that combination. But in these times, you know, people get called forth, and that happened to you as a scientist. You know, so that's a kind of parallel thing. What role, in your view, did Theo Colburn specifically play in the battle over fracking and the win for a ban for fracking in New York State, which just happened several days after her passing this last week?
Yes, it did. You know, and I can't think of a better homage Theo than the fact that we achieved this fracking ban. I mean, she was the first person I thought of as soon as I heard the words prohibit. That was the verb. That was the operative verb that came through the cabinet meeting that announced a ban on fracking. And I thought of Theo. We couldn't have done this without her, both again because of her science and also because of her courage in encouraging other scientists to get in there and fight for the science and not stand on the sidelines. It's hard to overstate her role in that. I mean, all that being said, you know, the fight against fracking in New York is an opera with a cast of thousands. And many, many stars had to align, not just scientific ones. Science was part of what won the day. And science for the people, you know, there's a cadre of us who went around year after year, every Friday night to some church basement somewhere, or a junior high school auditorium, or a Rotary Club, where we laid out the scientific evidence with PowerPoint presentations and whatever other, you know, tools of public speaking we had. And we wanted to bring the science to the people and have a very educated electorate who could then offer very intelligent and well-informed public comments during the deliberative process that went on when we were offering comments on the environmental impact statement and its various iterations, and then on the regulations for fracking. And so essentially, by translating the science on the risks and harms of fracking, some of which came right out of Theo's shop, the Endocrine Disruptors Exchange, and by getting that into the hands of people and then asking those same people to send in comments because they were now informed enough to show how these regulations were completely insufficient, we directed a record number of comments, 204,000 comments in the case of the draft regulations, and basically buried them alive in public comments. And, of course, Theo not only encouraged us in that way, but also had her own work. She did a variety of presentations that were videotaped and then that were available on her website, so that these videotapes of Theo herself laying out the risks and harms and the evidence thereof, people could gather in small groups or even at home in their bedrooms and simply watch Theo. She's a masterful teacher, so she could just explain all kinds of complicated organic chemistry in a way that anyone could understand. And, you know, she's so likable. And so she was just a very good messenger for all this.
Indeed. Yeah.
So, yeah, it was invaluable. I mean, that being said, we had all kinds of other people, too, right? We had filmmakers like Josh Fox, who loves Theo Colburn and who himself was educated at Theo's knee. And then we had musicians, and we had economists and mortgage lawyers who said, look, you know, fracking violates actually mortgage agreements with banks, especially secondary mortgage lenders. And so it wasn't all toxicology that won us the fracking ban. I want to be clear about that. But it certainly played a role. And I guess the part of the story that I feel it needs some correction, I mean, the story now of how New York beat fracking is rapidly being written.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this sort of idea that science and politics both played a role, but it's, you know, the sort of, in the conventional way of telling that, it's as though science and politics exist in two separate boxes, but they don't really. And it was Theo who showed us how science had to get in there into the public sphere and be a political force for change. That wasn't the opposite of being objective. You know, there's a difference, in other words, between being objective, which is good, and being neutral, which is not good, not when people's lives are at stake. That, in other words, science has a moral obligation. So if you're a scientist and you have this privileged knowledge that people are being harmed because of exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals, whether they come from fracking operations or somewhere else, then you had a moral obligation to get in there and make sure that regulations and laws were changed to prevent and eliminate those exposures. And if that's impossible to do, through a regulatory framework, well, then those chemicals simply needed to be abolished. And you know, Theo was just very clear about that, and it was so logical that many of us just kind of owe our perspective to her. And as for temperament, I absolutely have the wrong temperament for what I do. I'm actually pretty shy and squirrely and introverted, and would prefer, I think, to just sit around by myself and look at data and write about it. I could be alone for days on end and be perfectly happy. I don't like engaging in conversations with lots of people. And so to kind of be out there, I often joke that I've had to grow a whole new brain and become a whole different person in order to deal with this. But I think Winston Churchill said that best when he said, there's sometimes, I forget, this is an exact quote, but something about, you know, in times of great extremity and crisis, it's not enough to do your best. You have to do what's required. And if you have to become an entirely different person because that's what's required, that's what you do. And I don't really know how Theo felt about her own public persona, because she was out there so much, you know, always going to Washington and testifying. And I don't know if she too felt that was kind of went against her own temperament and against her own grain. I don't know. I know that Bill McGibbon and I both feel similarly, that if we'd just really like to be at our writing desk, but the times require something else. Now, you can't just be a kind of retiring, above the fray, conflict avoiding person. You just have to get off your knees and fight now.
You know, it's interesting, something that comes up a lot, because I come from the health field, right? And, you know, how to take care of your health, how to better your health, all the things that support health. And that's how I got into this. After hearing Theo present at Cooper Union, I was just, you know, used to reading the information about what's in a product that you could hold in your hand, and then she really had done the research that no one else was doing, that identified what some of these chemicals that were used to break rock and move the water through to get to the gas, and how intensely hazardous, carcinogenic, neurotoxic, et cetera, they were. And that was my personal wake-up call. But one of the things that I hear all the time in the health field about facing the heavy-duty times and the risks of fossil fuel development and a host of industrial practices is that, you know, we shouldn't face up to it. We shouldn't look at it too much, because the first thing you have to do, which is what they tell you to do on the airplane, is you have to put the oxygen mask on yourself. And if you're looking daily into, you know, the kind of guts of mechanisms that are really working against our health all the time, you know, you can only take so much of that before you have to go back to meditation, the oxygen mask, or whatever it is that would change the whole experience for you. And what I always say is, well, there's the story of the oxygen mask, which is you don't take care of the greater good before you've taken care of yourself. And sometimes taking care of the greater good leads you to go beyond and surpass, as you're describing, who you even think you are and what you're easiest capacities may be. And I said, and then there's the story of the mother who has to go over and lift the car that, you know, that their child has, you know, is under, and develop superhuman strength. And that's a whole different model. And that seems to me the model that you're describing.
Yeah, I completely reject the oxygen mask story for our current situation. And I don't take care of myself at all in any kind of traditional sense of things. I'm sure I've shortened my lifespan. Over the last 6 years of fighting fracking, I've probably pulled at least one all-nighter a week for the last 2 years, sometimes two or more. I'm always exhausted. I actually got pretty sick right after I heard the announcement about fracking. I've got a really bad respiratory infection, but I was out on the barricades today overseeing 9 arrests this morning and just bailed somebody out of jail right before I came home to talk to you, even though I should probably not be doing that right now. But look, the point is, we're at war here, And you do things at war that you know, it's not about taking care of yourself. We have 20 years at most. That's what the science shows, to decarbonize our planet, or all bets are off. That's when we hit the landmines in the road, what climate scientists call the tipping points, which I think is kind of an unfortunate term because it sounds so bland. But we should talk about them as landmines, because once that happens, then no matter what we do after that point is not fixable. You know, in other words, we don't have pollinators. In other words, the plankton stocks start crashing. Plankton provides us half the oxygen we breathe. And as soon as those things happen, then all of our ingenuity, all of our willingness to make change, it doesn't matter anymore. Civilization, as we know it, won't go on. So that happens within the lifetime of my children. We're in the middle of a mass species extinction. We've already lost half of the wildlife, half of the wildlife that used to exist 50 years ago when I was in kindergarten is gone. So the world is half as alive as it used to be within a human lifespan. Okay, so whatever my plans were for the next 20 years, that's gone now. My life's work is devoted to dismantling the oil and gas industry, period. That's all I want. That's the only thing on my bucket list. It's all I want to do, and I'm going to completely give my life over to that. It means that I have to be a crappy mom because I'm not doing homework with my kids. I'm not going to their, you know, I missed my son's opening night performance in a Shakespeare play because I forget what I was doing that night. I think I was testifying somewhere. But that's what we're called on to do now. So go do it, you know, go do it. I'm not going to be a good German who sees the sign of atrocity all around me of an ecological holocaust, knowing that my children will not even be able to live on this planet if I don't win. And then years later, when everything's horrible, say, well, I just didn't know what to do, you know, who knew? I mean, I know. I am a biologist. I know. So now we're going to fix this. I just was part of this incredible movement to ban fracking. We basically, David beat Goliath. And David beat Goliath with a slingshot made of science and love for our children and some really good political organizing. And what we've got going for us is that we love our children and we love this earth way more than oil and gas industry investors love their quarterly profits. That's what we've got, and then we can speak with our bodies. I've gone to jail twice in the last 2 years. You know, that's not taking care of myself, but it's taking care of the planet, which takes care of all of us. So I wrote an essay in jail when I was there a couple of weeks ago, right before Thanksgiving, called The Manifesto The Crappy Mom Manifesto, about the need for everyone to kind of give up their yoga clubs and their book clubs and whatever it is, you know, they're doing, and the driving their kids to soccer games and so on, and just get out there and deal with the whole environmental crisis, because everybody who's come before us has dithered around so long and with these kind of half measures and have allowed themselves to be paralyzed by despair and cynicism. And now it's, you know, not our fault, but we're the only adults left that can do something about it. We're the only adults left. I mean, our kids, by the time our kids are our age, it'll be too late. So, you know, we don't really have a choice here. So forget taking care of yourself.
I'm completely with you on that. It turned a corner for me from doing that kind of reporting to becoming the first kind of news cycle reporting, trotting around covering this issue, you know, after I heard Theo Colburn present on this once. I mean, that's basically what happened. She was on this radio show as well. But, you know, so where are we going next? Because one of the things, I mean, we've achieved something that obviously, you know, it's a huge victory. We can build on it. It should serve as an example, a role model, be implemented by others. But it isn't complete, you know, it's not like it's all over yet. We can go home and, you know, kind of kick back and go back to yoga class. There's still much more left to do. So why don't you share with our listeners, you know, what the ban is, what good it does for us, and where we need to go further, and where, you know, where you see this heading.
Well, the ban on fracking in New York is just, on the world scheme, a small victory. But I'm hoping it's a small victory that, that can leverage much bigger ones. You know, I don't know this for sure, but I would like to think this is our kind of what I call our lunch counter moment, right? That this, the fact that we in New York stood up to the oil and gas industry and you know, the fact that our bedrock under our homes, under our feet, happens to carry in it a mother load of methane gas trapped inside the rock as tiny bubbles, petrified. I always think of it like kind of a petrified spill of champagne that's trapped inside a rock. And the only way to get that is to blow it up, you know, using explosions, toxic chemicals, high pressure water, and a bunch of sand. It's a very, fracking is a brutal and primitive technology, and it gets, and what do we get at the end of the day? We get out a fossil fuel that leaks into the air as unburned methane, very potent greenhouse gas, 86 times more potent than carbon dioxide, and then when we burn it, we get another greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide itself. So we're going to risk all of this to extract a fossil fuel at a in a time of climate emergency when we're supposed to be decarbonizing, and instead what we're doing is further entrenching and building out capital-intense fossil fuel extraction projects that use our communities as its factory floor, and that once they're there, in order to recoup their investment, they're just going to have to frack and refrack and keep going for years and decades to come. Well, then it's too late after that, you know, to make change. Fracking, in other words, interrupts our project of trying to get renewable energy. It competes with that. So we have this sort of moral need to act in very big ways very quickly. So what I'm really hoping is that the spell has been kind of broken. When people see that a group of scientists and citizens can work together in politically smart ways to compel a governor to say no, and to compel the governor's Department of Health to investigate the health impacts, which we you know, insisted on doing, and it was done. And lo and behold, that Department of Health came to the same conclusions that we did independently as scientists when we looked at those data, which is that there's a lot of uncertainty in the data, but the signals that are there within the noise are troubling. And when you see troubling signs of harm, then benefit of the doubt goes to public health, not to the things that threaten public health. That's essentially the message of the New York State Health Department in their review of the health impacts of fracking. And so I hope that the battle we just won is like the Greensboro lunch counter movement, right? I mean, that moment was, it didn't mean that we had to go across the nation and desegregate one lunch counter after another. This is Bill McGibbon's big point. But rather, that one particular lunch counter was so inspiring that it showed that people could stand up to what seemed up to that point like an entrenched, intractable system of terror that was just unvanquishable and win. And then once that small group of people who sat down in Greensboro, South Carolina, won, and everyone saw that happen on their televisions, then all kinds of things shifted. So that's what I'm hoping. I mean, and I see signs of it, right? So within the first 24 hours of the announcement of New York, I had literally 1,900 emails, and they came in from all around the world, from South Africa and North Ireland and Australia and from almost every state in the union, both offering us congratulations but also asking, how can we replicate that here?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I think of this as I think of a plot of a story that my son used to like when he was 8, and that was about the time that we really started, or I certainly started, fighting fracking in great earnest, and it became my overwhelming obsession. And now he's going to go to high school next year, so it's been a big chunk of his childhood has been lived in this sort of, you know, mom's at war kind of mentality around here. But when he was 8, one of his favorite books was a kind of retelling of the Russian folktale that is the narrative of the of the ballet of Stravinsky's Firebird. And in that story, the hero of the story is this prince, Prince Ivan, and who finds himself in this strange kingdom that's ruled over by a character named Koschei the Deathless, who is has turned all of his subjects to stone, and everything in his kingdom is now completely lifeless. And so Ivan has to go to battle now with this seemingly unvanquishable foe who cannot be killed. So how can you kill someone who's unkillable, who's deathless? And of course he has to have an assist from the Firebird, and I think of the Firebird as kind of like our elected officials, right?
The minute he was deathless, I knew he was a problem.
Right, right. Well, Ivan is the one that still has to fight him. It's not the Firebird. Mm-hmm. And so the interesting part of the story is not necessarily how Ivan wins, but what happens after that, which is that as soon as Ivan the Deathless is dead, all the subjects that have been turned to stone come back to life. And I think what that means is that, you know, the other part of it is that Ivan had been warned over and over again, you know, go from this place. No one can do this. You can't kill Koschei the Deathless. And it just reminded me so much of those days when, you know, no, go from this place. Anti-frackers, you cannot, you know, ban fracking. You can only sit around the table and regulate it. And, you know, you can tell us what rules you want, but you can't just say no. You know, that's not off the table here. That's just not realistic. But, you know, we just, through, you know, as my friend, the attorney Helen Slatchy, this year's Goldman Prize winner, said about that, she said, I don't want a seat at the table. I want the table overturned, and I want to see teeth on the floor. You know, that she brought this kind of fighting spirit to it all and took a no means no kind of mentality to the whole thing. And that's what Theo kind of taught us, I think. So that was my son's favorite story, and I think that's what's happened in New York. You know, we're Prince Ivan. We have slain Koschei the Deathless, and all of a sudden people realize they don't have to be garden statuary. You know, they feel alive. They feel like they have agency. And so this kind of learned helplessness is kind of been lifted a little bit. And I hope that will pay off in huge ways. I mean, that has this big, big value. And I realize how much energy for me has gone into, as you know, one of the people kind of out front in this movement, and kind of like the chick singer in the band, right? Like I was the one whose job kind of was to fill the house and give inspiring speeches and so on, as well as lay the data out. And so I spent a lot of time just convincing people that they didn't need to sit around and try to figure out what our odds of winning were, that the chances of winning were zero if we did nothing. So we just had to keep putting one foot in front of the other and believe that we could do this. Play to win. Play hard. Empty your bank account. Empty your heart. Just go, 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 go. And there's, I don't know, you can kind of create your own self-fulfilling prophecy, right? And I think the hardest thing for me is not the data and not people's denial of science. I can deal with that. It's people's denial that they have political agency, that
right.
their defeatism before they even begin. I can disavow them of kind of biological mythology and give them the facts, but I can't provide people the feeling that they should stand up and fight, that everybody has to find that on their own. But when we have a win like this, it just makes it easier for people, I think, because my biggest problem is despair and cynicism, and which I see as a form of complicity.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we should. I think it's disallowed. I would like to banish it if I could. I can't. You know, people have their feelings, but those feelings are exit doors for people. It's a form of paralysis and learned helplessness that makes it very hard to even try. And you know, when there's no clear path forward, you have to just find it. You have to invent it. You just have to move and try stuff. You can always recalibrate, you know, as you fail. But standing around watching us just you know, get closer and closer to the cliff of complete climate catastrophe is just not an option, I think. So I had a kind of another lesson in all this when during my last jail term, which this particular time ended up in a cell block with a whole bunch of also women who are also new admits, almost all of whom were addicts, and which are, you know, not unusual because that's most of the jail population, really. But they were all kind of detoxing at the same time and just miserable physically. And as I got to know them better and as we talked from cell to cell, it you know, was clear that every single one of these women had been sexually molested as a child and was self-medicating with drugs and was desperate to get off of them, but had just never known a normal life. Like, I was the only person they ever knew who had been married. I mean, we were all mothers, but marriage was just not part of their world. And their partners were not necessarily lovingly supporting them. And their baby daddies were all kinds of different men, most of whom were violent. And in some cases, in one case in particular, the father of the children of one of these women was her own father.
Mm.
And so just that kind of unspeakable abuse and humiliation that these women experienced was so much different than my own life, right? But there's one thing that I realized we just had in common, and that sort of epiphany of mine came when one of these women said to me one day, because she'd been trying so hard to stop the substance abuse and had been, you know, clean for 3 years, but then completely failed about the time her own daughter was raped at age 7, because it brought up all of her own childhood rape experiences, and she swore that would never happen to her daughter, but it did, and then, you know, then the drugs came back. So she said, I'm not trying to find myself. I'm trying to create myself because I don't know what's supposed to be normal. I've never had anything normal.
Mm.
And I thought, well, you know, in an external way, that's how I feel. We've been so abused by the fossil fuel industry for so long that, you know, I don't know what it would be like to be in a world where we didn't rely on fossil fuels and weren't dependent on them for our whole economic system wasn't greased by fossil fuels. So I can't find that world. I have to create it, knowing that somehow what's happening now is just not working for my kids and for the whole ecological system. So we're trying to do something here that nobody really has experienced in their lifetimes, because the fossil fuel era has been here for much longer than we have. So it's the world we're trying for is experientially unknown to us. It's a vision. So my struggle externally in the political world really mimicked the sort of internal battles that a lot of my community of women when I was incarcerated were going through.
Mm. Well, you know, it also sounds in a way like it has reference to all of us in this society. And, you know, people are sticking to the tracks that work because the dangers of stepping out of it, not belonging, getting out of the economic system in the known way, especially at a time of economic instability, as we're now in, along with environmental instability, it's kind of like people are really frightened. They don't have a sense of choice or opportunity if they don't stick to the formula in some kind of sense. And so the fact that we're then entering, actually science is, I notice in media conversations and exchanges, is actually misused, because science is supposed to provide certainty about what formula to stick to, not open the door to say we need to now step out and enter a different realm, and you know, a realm that we have to invent. It's actually an extraordinary creative, spiritual, you know, amazing opportunity if you like that kind of thing. But on the other hand, it is, you know, I'm sure perceived, because I think about that whole thing too. How do we get people to engage? What, you know, why is it hard for them? You know, and I think that, stepping beyond the known pattern, is really a big part of it.
for people. They're really frightened to, because they don't sense that they're in a safe place to experiment. You know, what you describe is that we are forced by the lack of safety, about the dangers, about the pressing dangers, to, you know, invent something new, to step out there. You know, but our models even of creativity and art really a lot have to do, you know, with safer forms than that. What is there some way in which Theo's model, or perhaps something else in your life, gave you this capacity? Is it a matter of deep caring? You know, is it some other modeling that you had? Is it something about science that you've understood? You know, any thoughts about that?
Well, I suppose we all bring our own autobiographies to our struggles. I know that I have thought recently a lot, not so much about being a cancer survivor, which is you know, been a big part of my life and continues to be. But, in fact, I'm sitting here staring at a note from my gastroenterologist. It's time for me to have another colonoscopy. So I have them actually annually, and have done so since I was in my 30s because of precancerous colon lesions that I developed, which, you know, after having had bladder cancer, makes everyone wonder if I have a kind of genetic predisposition to big ticket malignancies. So I you know, in terms of, I guess I'm kind of circling around to the idea of taking care of ourselves personally. I have two kids, and my own husband is disabled from a stroke, so I can't mess up. I have to go in and have my cystoscopes and my colonoscopies, and I'm a good soldier about all of that. But I don't think so much about that anymore, even though I'm dealing with other people's water contamination, right? So in other words, with fracking, what you get a lot of times is drinking water contamination. And I grew up with drinking water contamination. There were bladder carcinogens in my hometown drinking water well. That's kind of the punchline of one of my earlier books, Living Downstream. So you might imagine that I would be thinking a lot about the misery of being diagnosed with cancer young, that would sort of drive my work now. But it's not really, and I think it's in part because I need to kind of feel like invincible right now. I feel passive when I think of myself as a cancer patient. And so I don't identify with that part of my life, even though I have to go in and out of it again. Mm-hmm. I did when I wrote Living Downstream, because I really wanted to give voice and pull back the curtain on the lived life of a cancer survivor, where there's all kinds of uncertainties. You know, it's not just you either have cancer or you don't. You're either in remission or you're not. There's so many years of your life that can go by where the blood tests are sort of ambiguous and the imagery is not really clear, so you're in this period of watchful waiting. And it's a very vulnerable period. And so I've kind of explicated that a lot for my readers and spent a lot of time talking about that in a very vulnerable way. But I don't do that anymore. And what I do think about, though, a lot is the part of my life that has to do with me being adopted and what that means. You know, I was surrendered as an infant and then became a ward of the state and was adopted officially, informally, when I was about 9 months old. And so what I think about is the role of that government has. So here I was, an abandoned newborn. The official terminology of the day was surrendered, which is like a crazy word, right? Like as though at birth I had already given up. I had surrendered. So I was surrendered at the hospital, and so became a ward of the state. And it was really the job of the state government of Illinois to take care of me, right? Because I couldn't take care of myself. I was a newborn. Mm-hmm. And they had to find a family for me to grow up in, and they did a really good job. And that is the job of government. It's tasked with looking out for the security and well-being of the citizenry, to protect us against threats that we can't protect ourselves against. And so in some cases that means finding a family for a surrendered newborn, and in other cases it means making sure that our energy systems aren't contaminating the air and water of our communities. So I'm really interested in thinking about making government live up to its responsibilities to protect us rather than ensure the business plans of the fossil fuel industry. So, and also, I've been thinking a lot lately about how deeply I care about the whole of creation and the whole ecological world. I mean, I think I became an evolutionary biologist in part in order to have a family tree. Having no ancestors of my own, I kind of sank my tack roots down into the whole Darwinian tree of life. Mm-hmm. And so I find a lot of meaning in that. And because I don't have necessarily a particular tribe of people that I identify with, then I tend to identify with anyone who's in a very vulnerable situation, anyone who's surrendered, you know, and that may mean a group of people who are sacrificed because their community is now a fracking extraction zone.
Right.
So my allegiance, you know, is with underdogs, and the vulnerable, the cast off, you know, the forgotten, the sacrificed, and so on. And I have a feeling that is part of the whole adoption thing. But also, I think as a scientist, I'm really interested in the way our ecology shapes who we are and how the environmental signals we receive actually alter our gene expression.
Yes.
Yeah, and so I think anyone who's adopted, like, the data are just there, right? But our ability to see the data sort of depends on what your mind is open to. And because I was a co-cancer patient at the same time as my mom, because my aunt died of the same kind of bladder cancer I had, but I'm adopted and I don't share genes with these folks, it gave me this window that made it easier for me to see the way in which our environment can actually shape our gene expression. And so everything that Theo was writing about, which somehow, you know, she's obviously you don't have to be an adoptee to think those thoughts, but I was receptive to them, I think, because of my own particular biography.
You know, there is something in the gene expression thing as well, which is that there's an interaction between each of us and all of us and our environment. There's an intimate interaction between, you know, me and the environment and you and the environment, you know, and all of the things that come from that, from outside in and from inside out. And so things are kind of more in flux and modifiable. And I think that's also the great sort of scientific metaphor of gene expression, is that there isn't absolute certainty that this does that and does this. There's kind of a symphony, and you had mentioned, you know, that the fracking movement was like an opera of different characters, but there's a symphony of different influences, and we can't necessarily kind of nail down every one before we can, you know, so there's there are some areas which have been proven by science, but there's also, because of the complexity and that interactivity, there's a flux that goes on where we don't know how all of these different things interact to either create health in us, to create ecological imbalance, or to create a movement in the political system that will find its way to success in, you know, in changing things more favorably for all of us. And so there's creative possibility there. So perhaps that sense of creative possibility comes from your direct experiences, you know, in the ways that you describe, as well as being a scientist. And it kind of gives the room to try to set up the right conditions for the right things to happen.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, certainly if you don't know your own, if you have no medical history, if you don't know who your biological parents are, or anyone who came before you, then, you know, you're dealing with a lot of enforced secrecy and a lot of uncertainty. So I suspect some of my real impatience with enforced secrets have a lot to do with having to, you know, being adopted in the 50s in a time when we were all just going to pretend this person wasn't adopted. In fact, I even have a false birth certificate, right? That's the only time that it's somehow legal to falsify a document in the public record is to give a false birth certificate to an adopted person when they're, when they're adopted, and your other birth certificate is sealed and this new fake one is put in the public record, and that's the one that is the basis for my passport and everything else, right? And so, you know, now I'm dealing with fracking where they don't have to reveal the chemicals they use. They have non-disclosure agreements in all their contract with landowners. And so there's all this sort of enforced secrecy. And secrecy breeds fear. It does in adoption and it does in fracking. And so, you know, I've been,
and it does
my whole life
I've
been very
united,
big on disclosure.
Where where we don't know where, you know, who's funding elected officials that we're voting for, who's paying for their advertising.
Yeah. Well, it's very hard to make rational decisions when you don't have all the necessary knowledge base, right? And, I mean, I would be able to make much better decisions about my own health if I had knowledge of a pedigree, you know, if I had some medical history. I'm not denying that genes and inheritance are not determinative and important in some way, but not having that, any of that, and only knowing my ecological roots, I can also say that it seems to me that there's a wrong presumption that what runs in families necessarily runs in genes rather than in our shared environment. And I think, my autobiography and the data suggest that it's the environment that plays the lion's share of the story of cancer, the story of learning disabilities, the story of, you know, even how old you are when you got your first period, right, has a lot to do with your nutritional status as a girl, as well as your endocrine exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals, Theo Kohlberg's whole argument. And so I think those of us who have these kind of alternative biographies can often create data that are kind of a corrective to some untested presumptions that are kind of dominant in society. And Theo's own biography, you know, as somebody who was a pharmacist, as someone who was a rancher, who had experience with reproductive biology from the point of view of livestock, as somebody who then was a wildlife biologist who worked in the field. I mean, she just had a whole variety of points of view, you know. I mean, that's what you get when you get old. You get wise. You have, especially if you are not just in the same laboratory studying some version of the same single problem, but rather range so widely in your inquiry.
And you learn a few things.
You learn a few things, and you also just learn different models and different hypotheses and different sort of methods of inquiry. So she just had a lot of arrows in her quiver, I think. Just this incredibly wide-ranging mind. I feel like I'm that's why I'm so miserably slow as a writer, Allison. It's because I'm very deliberative, you know, and I tend to see, the complexity rather than the sort of the easy path from point A to point B. So, therefore, I write very slowly.
I can identify with that, but you know, it takes me years actually to kind of distill something. But you do it beautifully, and we're coming to the end of our hour. I want to. I've loved this conversation. It's wonderful hearing your thoughts and reflections. Thank you, Sandra Steingraber. And listeners, do check out Raising Elijah. You can go to Sandra's website, sandrasteingraber.com, or steingraber.com, in order to follow her work on fracking and what's going on and get involved. You can learn more about Theo Kohlberg at endocrinedisruption.org. Beautiful biography. People are sharing about her. That's the organization that began the whole look into endocrine disrupting chemicals. Thank you so much, Sandra, for being with us.
Thanks for having me. And I'd encourage all the listeners to check out We Are Seneca Lake. That's the current civil disobedience uprising here in where I live in the Finger Lakes region of New York. We just arrested 9 more people this morning for 170 civil disobedience in the last few weeks.
This work is continuing. Listeners, be involved. Thank you for being with us, and tune in next week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, Wednesdays.